A First Coast public figure makes a splash by making a simple yet powerful change. Good morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect, and I'm Melissa Ross. Thanks for listening. And just ahead, a conversation with Channel 4 news anchor Melanie Lawson on coming out with her natural hair, that is. You can get on the line now and join us. It's 549-2937. Then later, public art in and around Jacksonville, why it's growing. Plus a preview of our brand new pop-up jazz station here at 89.9. That's ahead too. All of that and more coming up this morning. But first this hour, we are going to have a conversation about hair. Yeah, hair. In the 2009 documentary film Good Hair, comedian Chris Rock explored the importance of hair in Black culture, especially for women.
Relaxer. The closest thing we have to a nap antidote. For all you white people out there that don't know what it is, you name a Black woman, any Black woman, no matter how famous or infamous, they've either had their hair relaxed or they're having their hair relaxed right now.
If your hair is relaxed, white people are relaxed. If your hair is nappy, they're not happy.
How about that? Well, if you watch local television newscasts, for example, in most cities in America, chances are when you catch female anchors of color appearing on television, their hair is also relaxed. Until recently, that also included Channel 4 anchor Melanie Lawson Minor. Melanie caused a bit of a splash when she recently decided to grow out her natural hair and wear it that way on TV, too. We spoke with Melanie about the change and why it's about so much more than just a hairstyle. Let's listen. Melanie Lawson Minor, thanks for being with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.
You made a big change recently, one that Channel 4 viewers are certainly noticing and giving you feedback about. You decided to wear your hair naturally on camera.
Yeah, it's something I've been contemplating now for probably about a year or so. I have very tightly curled hair. And, you know, all my life I've been either straightening it with a chemical or with heat. The last year I've been wearing a wig actually on Channel 4, which I named Michelle because I had to have a relationship with her. She's my friend and foe all at the same time. But, you know, while I was wearing Michelle, it was allowing my natural hair to grow out while I cut off the relaxed hair. I got to the point where I was comfortable with it. I was happy with the style, the color, and I had, you know, conversations with my management, and voila.
And so for years as a news anchor, though, you had to relax your hair or wear a wig. You had to straighten your hair, in effect, which is what so many African-American women do. What is it like for you now that you don't have to do that?
Right. So I will say I didn't have to straighten my hair, I should say. I chose to straighten my hair, and I also chose not to be different. I chose not to have an uncomfortable conversation about my hair and how it would look if I didn't straighten my hair. And I also chose to not explore that side of me, which I had suppressed since I was a little girl. You know, my mom would straighten my hair, and that's how we'd go to Easter Sunday with straightened, curly, loose curled hair that wasn't natural. So it was a choice to not have that conversation. I can remember when I first started wearing my natural hair, and I had a conversation with a manager, and it was like, whoa, well, if you do that, there are a lot of things that we are going to have to consider, like how you look in the promo. It'll be different than how you look on television. And we have to get the consultants involved to make sure that, you know, it's going to be okay. And so that kept me quiet a little longer because I wasn't sure how it would be received. But when I was ready, and so that made me say, Melanie, if you're going to do this, you've got to be comfortable. You have got to, you know, say it like you mean it and actually do it and feel confident and comfortable no matter what the response is going to be. And so it was one of those things where I think I was more scared to approach it than they actually were to accept it.
And it's been great to see that the viewing public has really embraced it, and you look great.
Thank you.
And let me ask you about this too, because I think for all women, hair is such a fraught minefield, because how we wear our hair is communicating so much about us
It's so much deeper than cosmetic. But for women of color especially, the topic of hair is really, really heavy. And through the centuries, there has been this pressure, I think, to conform to a more Caucasian standard of beauty. But increasingly, women are saying, no, this is who I am, and this is how I look, and how I look is beautiful.
Yeah. So you grow up, and what's beautiful, the models that who you see, you know, the people you admire, they all had this straight, silky hair. And that is always personified as what's beautiful, what's accepted. And how your hair is, how it grows out of your head as a Black woman, wasn't considered beautiful. It was the before. Give me the after. And, you know, over the last, 10 years, so what I'm doing isn't revolutionary. You know, you go back to the 60s when afros and curly hair was everything, and that was a sign of empowerment and positivity. But then we went through this phase of, Jerry curls and these harsh relaxers. And I pointed out in my article I wrote for Channel 4, these would cause scabs in your head, and you're literally like, I'm going to deal with this because if the chemical really works and straightens my hair, it's worth this pain. So then I saw my friends. My friends started, not relaxing their hair, not weaving, putting weave in their hair. And they had these beautiful curls and, tight curls, loose curls. I mean, beautiful, beautiful hair that they had been hiding. And they didn't even know what their hair would do because you got this chemical in your hair as soon as you were able to really start styling your hair. So sometimes 6, 7 years old, there are little girls in there getting these chemicals in their hair. And so there's this birth of like, my curls are popping, curly hair, don't care, big hair, don't care. I mean, all the hashtags are out there where there's just this pride and forcing people to accept what was once looked at as unacceptable. Now, What I don't know if everybody's as aware of and people who are dealing with it are, but there's still so much discrimination in the field of hair. I mean, you just the military saying, oh, you can't wear your braids or your locks because it's unkept. Or, if you're going to pick your kids up from school, your hair has to look a certain kind of way. We just did that story last week. The hair is a form of, it can be a form of discrimination because as my hair grows, it is not acceptable and I'm being banned from certain spaces because of the choice that I make to wear my hair. So this is almost like in your face, this is a choice, this is me. You know, everyone who looks in the mirror and changes who they are to conform or to be more beautiful per se, or to fit in, there was a girl the other who today was like, I didn't straighten my hair today with my blow dryer and my flat iron because of you. So I think this is something that all people can relate to some extent because, make the choice that's best for you. Now, historically, as a Black woman, we've dealt with it in a different way. But I think it can resonate with anyone who is making changes with their look to conform.
I would think, too, for young girls that watch you on the news and see your natural hair, that's powerful.
Yeah, I mean, that's what gives you chills about it, And I've said that my daughter has really been my impetus for why I've made this decision, because she looked at my wig and's like, Mommy, I want straight hair like you. And I'm like, Leia, this is Michelle. This is my wig. What's underneath my hair is just like your hair. But she still would be so fixated on this wig. So now that I don't wear it, Well, when I didn't wear it on the weekend, she's like, Mommy, we are twins. We're best friends. You look like me. I look like you. And so I knew I can't be duplicitous and say, this is the look that I'm giving you on the weekend. But when I go to work, Mommy puts on her straight hair and this is the look that's acceptable. I needed her to see Mommy being acceptable in all environments, looking like her. And so I asked her last week because I picked her from school with my natural hair. And I was like, Mom, I said, Leah, do you like Mommy's hair? And she's like, oh, I love your hair. I like it like this better. Mm-hmm. And I know that eventually that will instill in her that she's OK just as she is. And the idea that, moms have emailed me and texted me and Facebooked me and said that, you are the example that we will use to let my daughter know that she's beautiful no matter how she chooses to wear her hair.
Well, you look beautiful, and thank you so much for telling your hair story.
Yay.
With us. Thanks, Melanie.
Of course. Thank you for having me.
That's Channel 4's Melanie Lawson Minor. So hair can often be more than hair. This is a fascinating topic, and right now we're pleased to get some insights about it from Dr. Jeffrey Ann Wilder. She's a research scientist with the National Center for Women and Information Technology, and she's on the line. Dr. Wilder, good morning.
Good morning.
Okay, so hearing Melanie's story was really fascinating, and it's a story arc I think a lot of women of color have made in this country. As you listened to her talk about her hair, what were you thinking?
Her story is my story.
Yeah?
Absolutely. I mean, I have struggled for years, working as a professor in a predominantly white environment, thinking that I had to have straight hair in order to be considered more professional or to be taken seriously. And it took me a few years into my career to feel comfortable doing different things with my hair, so experimenting with braids or weaves or extensions or doing my own hair in different ways because, you know, as Melanie pointed out, we have it historically, our society looks upon European standards of beauty, so straight hair, in other words, as more acceptable. And for women of color and girls of color feel that they have to conform to those standards. Well, not anymore. I think it's a beautiful rebirth of what we've seen in previous decades, as Melanie talked about in the 60s, where women and girls of color are starting to embrace their whole selves. And by the way, whole selves, embracing that could be, you know, wearing your natural hair naturally, curly or coily one day, straight the next, using some extensions. I think it's really wonderful because now we're at a place where women of color are pushing back against societal standards, and society is starting to accept that. We're seeing so many women of color and girls of color, even in the media, on TV. We saw Viola Davis's character do this, pull off her wig, a few seasons ago on How to Get Away with Murder to reveal her natural hair. So we're starting to see this more, and I think it's a wonderful, beautiful widespread acceptance of ourselves.
There's even a petition at change.org that NPR did a story about recently to include the Afro hair emoji on the emoji keyboard because it doesn't exist currently. What do you think, too, about what we listen to in terms of how you wear your hair is political in some respects? If you have an afro or curly hair, big hair that isn't straightened, it can actually get you banned from certain professional spaces or you can be deeply discouraged from wearing your hair that way. So as a sociologist and a social scientist, what do you think that says? Why is there still so much discomfort on the part of white people when it comes to that particular hairstyle?
Because it's unknown. And it may have a lot to do with the fact that, again, when you think historically about how these kinds of hairstyles are portrayed, it's portrayed negatively. Now, New York City banned, discrimination, anyone discriminating against someone for their hair. They did that probably last month. And then more recently, California, the state of California, unanimously decided to ban discrimination based upon hair. 30 years ago, that was not the case. 30 years ago, there was a woman of color who worked for one of the airlines, and she lost her job because her cornrows were not deemed professional. So I think there is this historically, and even still to a certain extent today, because, the way women of color's hair grows, right, not straight out of their head, it grows curly or kinky or coily, there's a sense of, there's a certain level of discomfort about that. And a feeling that that's not professional, that's not okay. But again, I'm really glad that we are pushing back and forcing folks to reconsider the way in which they think about what is natural, what is beautiful, and what's normal. So what we're starting to see is that society is starting to normalize different kinds of hair.
And lots of calls. We want to hear your hair stories this morning as we talk about this with Channel 4's Melanie Lawson Minor and Dr. Jeffrey Ann Wilder. It's 549-2937. Vanessa is in Atlantic Beach. Hey, Vanessa, good morning. Go ahead.
Hey, good morning, Melissa. I love the show.
Thanks.
I love this topic. Thanks so much. My comment is I'm an African-American woman. My story's a little different. My mom is from Africa. My father's from Atlantic Beach. And so I decided when I was in, like, the 10th grade to not perm my hair anymore and not relax my hair, straighten it. And I got so many different things, like outrage. I don't know. People were just questioning. I mean, people of my own race and things like that. But I made that choice for myself because my hair really wouldn't relax all the way in this Florida humidity anyway.
Mm-hmm.
But since then, I've had two daughters, and they've never seen me with my hair any other way than dreadlocks. And people, sometimes there's a stigma with locks, especially men of color with locks. But I'm hoping to set up a nice standard for my daughters. And moving forward, now I work at the Ritz Theater.
Yeah.
And we just had a natural hair exhibit for the fine arts photographer, Aaron Mervin. And we will be having a hair and fashion show coming up based off of that exhibit for our anniversary later on in the year.
Oh, you know what? I'm so glad you told us about that. And if I had known, I would have booked you guys to come on and talk about that in a little more detail as part of this segment. So everybody, check out the Ritz Theater. You should check it out anyway, because they have an incredible museum of African-American history and culture in the city and cool exhibits like that. So, Vanessa, thanks for sharing that with us.
No problem. Thanks, you guys.
Thank you so much. Jeffrey and Wilder, you know, when she talked about her locks, it reminded me of an incident that happened a few years ago on E! News. I don't know if you remember this, but the singer and actress Zendaya appeared on TV at an award show with her locks, with her hair in locks. And one of the anchors on E! News said that that hairstyle reminded her of patchouli and weed. Do you remember that?
I do.
And that, and it was quite controversial. And of course, Zendaya took the opportunity to sort of educate the public about her hair and why locks are beautiful and a perfectly acceptable way to wear your hair, because that's just how her hair grew. And so when I heard Vanessa talking about her locks, that's what it reminded me of, and how culturally this is still a really kind of fraught issue for Americans, isn't it?
Absolutely. And so, you know, connecting things like, you know, dreadlocks to, you know, sort of criminalizing that, or sort of automatically assuming that your hair means that you're deviant in some type of way, is extremely problematic. And it's taking folks like Zendaya and others to sort of come front and center and say, that's not okay to associate, you know, your hair with something that folks deem to be negative. And then more importantly, I think it's just, again, you know, we also have to remember that, you know, black women, regardless of their hairstyles, are still facing lots of scrutiny by the TSA because of their hair. So it's bigger than just someone deciding that they're taking a, you know, personal stance in order to feel more beautiful. It really is the fact that society is still deeming a lot of black hairstyles, a lot of black women's hairstyles, as negative, derogatory, or bad. And what I really appreciate the caller bringing up is the fact that it's not just folks outside the black community, that a lot of times folks within the black community think negatively about and internalize those negative images about hair and make other people feel like, you know, it's not okay for them to wear their natural hair, that, you know, straighter hair is a lot more acceptable in society. So I think it's really interesting, all the various conversations that are happening now. I don't think we could have had these conversations 20 years ago or 30 years ago. It's a beautiful thing that's mm-hmm. happening. And, you know,
yeah.
I have a daughter too. And
sure. So yeah. You're modeling for your daughter. And let me, if I could, we just simply have jammed phone lines on this hot topic. Let's get to some more calls. Wells is in Atlantic Beach. Wells, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Good morning, Melissa, and your guests. This is a really interesting, powerful discussion. One of the things I wanted to bring up was that, you know, anytime African-Americans express their pride in the way they look and in their history, whether it be here in America or in Africa, that is really deemed a threat to the status quo. I think we have to understand colonialism also to understand what's happening and what has happened. I'm 72 years old, and back in the 60s when we started to wear our hair natural, or as we call them, afros, it gave us a sense of pride and dignity. And surprisingly enough, people don't want us to have that. Melba Moore, who was, I think, the first black anchor who wore a hair natural on TV back in New York, caught a lot of flack for it.
That was back in the 70s, wasn't it?
70s, yeah.
Yeah, and there used to be an anchor in Atlanta, Monica Kaufman. She may still be on the air up there. She made national news, too, when she made this decision well. So, yeah.
Right. This is also, you know, the discussion that we're not having about race and racism in America. I mean, you know, if you look back at the 60s, before the death of Dr. King and the dismantling of the civil rights movement, you know, we had terms like I'm black and I'm proud, which was something that we had never really spoke about up until the civil rights movement out loud to, you know, the wider, broader society. So I think this is a very very powerful discussion, and I'd like to see it continue somewhere down the line. Thank you.
Thank you, Wells. Thanks for your thoughts and that historical perspective, too, and so many calls. What are your thoughts as we talk hair on the show this morning? Scott is in Orange Park. Go ahead, Scott. Oh, we lost that call. Let's go to Sally in St. Augustine. Hey, Sally, thanks for holding. Go ahead.
Hi. So I read Melanie's article yesterday, and I learned so much. I am a Caucasian woman. I've had my own hair issues, but I never realized the types of issues that women of color have had to endure just to feel that they're, you know, pleasing others or for whatever reason. But one of the comments on that article really frustrated me. That one of the readers said, why are we talking about this? Why is this news? But I think that misses the point that, you know, as a society, we're only going to get closer and more empathetic toward each other when we learn more about each other and learn more of those little day-to-day struggles that never would occur to you if you are going through those problems.
Yeah.
So I just appreciate that you guys are bringing attention to this, and good for Melanie. I think it's an amazing step, and I really support that.
Thank you, Sally. And, you know, we're getting tweets, too, Dr. Wilder, saying, why is this news? Why is this worth talking about? And I think that the answer to that is that this is about more than hair. This is about culture. This is about race. This is about politics. This is about our history as a country, as the previous caller said. This is a deeper discussion than how we wear, how a woman chooses to wear her hair, right?
Absolutely, especially if you have to seek out legislation to ban hair discrimination. It's also a conversation about colorism, something that folks don't know a whole lot about, and that's internalized discrimination within communities of color that talk about how we tear each other down. So, yeah, I saw that thread, too. It's important because if you don't know, you're ignorant, and that's not a good thing. It's important to have this conversation because there's lots of people who really don't know.
Now, at the beginning of the hour, I played a clip from the Chris Rock documentary, Good Hair, that he produced and appeared in 2009. And that was an eye-opener for me, Jeffrey Ann, when I learned about just how big a business relaxers and wigs and weaves are in the African-American community. And the lengths that women go to relax their hair, and how often they can literally damage their scalp, deeply damage it in order to get relaxed hair, to conform to this standard of beauty. And when you talked about colorism, that reminded me of another movie that educated me about colorism. And that came out quite some time ago. It was Spike Lee's film School Days, about the life on a historically black college campus. And in that film, there were kind of two camps of girls or young women on the campus, the lighter skinned girls with the straight hair and the darker skinned girls with curly hair, and how much tension there was between those two groups of students. And so that was also, I think, a good cultural example looking at some of these issues. And I would encourage people to check out that movie, too, to kind of get a little bit more about this. And let's go to Scott in Orange Park. Hi, Scott. You called back. Go ahead.
Hi, how you doing?
Good, go ahead.
I dated a black girl a couple years ago. Got pregnant and lost a child. So one of the comments that she made was, oh, finally get a kid with good hair. And I was like, I was taken aback. Like, I was like, what? Because she has, you know, she keeps it pretty natural. She combs it out, but keeps it pretty natural. Doesn't use product on it to straighten it. And she said, it's just for manageability. But the idea that I would have that stuck in my head, that somebody, you know, there's like two camps. There's people who would be are offended by anybody who's different than them. Back in the day, punk rockers would get it for having mohawks because you're different, because you don't conform, because you don't fit the norm. But a lot of that's ingrained. You were talking about movies. Remember Charlton Heston in Omega Man? Here he's the last man on Earth, and the woman in right. it is a black woman, and they don't get together because they're the last breeding couple on Earth, and she's black. So he has an issue with it. How ingrained in society and in us because of it is it that we don't celebrate diversity like we should? We don't look at something different and say, oh, isn't that a wonderful expression? There's people that live and breathe that, oh, you're different, and oh, you must conform, and oh, you don't fit us.
Yeah.
And I think until we change that, I think that, you know, we might have to legislate it till it gets there.
Thank you, Scott. Thanks for those thoughts. Tony at the beaches. Go ahead, Tony. What do you think?
Hi, thank you. Well, I do want to make a comment about, I'm Caucasian, I'm half Italian and the rest European, and I have wavy hair, very wavy hair. And I know that I understand the racial issue here, but I think the culture as a whole does not accept people who have what they consider unruly hair. You know, I think that we're not accepted if we let our hair be natural, that it's assumed that we're unkept or immature and we're not taken seriously, or you're uneducated, or somehow you do get set aside and somehow made to feel that somehow you don't fit in. And recently, in the last couple of years, I decided to let my hair just be kind of what it is. And I would get up and I'd look, and it's really curly and it's 6 inches shorter than when I straighten it, you know, and put it in a clip. And go out, and I've had comments like, you got to do something with your hair. I said, I did. I got up, and I'm here. What do I have to do with my hair so that everybody is comfortable and happy? And so I understand this issue. I just wanted to say that I appreciate this conversation. It's a conversation that should be had, because I don't think people with curly hair or who don't have curly hair of some kind, they don't understand.
Thank you, Tony. Yeah. So many stories flowing into the show. Tweets, too. Here's one from Jim. Don't forget about the local hero, Moxie Girl, who uses her afro puffs as her superpower. That's a children's book written by a great kid here in Jacksonville. If you go on Twitter, just follow Moxie Girl Comics for more about that. Willie is in Murray Hill. Go ahead, Willie.
Good morning, Melissa. Enjoy your show and your topic. I was just one of the ladies who made a statement about black folk wasn't comfortable with the locks. And I'm one of them black people. And took me a while to come around to it, because I grew up with looking like black women looking like white women. That's beautiful. And it took me a minute, and I was on a date, and I kept staring at the lady's hair, and she got up and left, and I just wasn't comfortable, and I tried to explain to her, but it's a big culture thing, too, because if you got to look more like a white woman. You look at all these black women walking around with these wigs on. Subconsciously, they want to be like a white lady. But y'all have a good day.
All right, Willie, thanks for that. So, Jeffrey Ann, so as you mentioned, Willie's talking about colorism, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's important for us to think about, you know, we've been talking about things that happened in the 1960s and before then, and, you know, people should just, you know, feel comfortable. We have to, you know, go back to history and realize this all started, you know, in the 1600s and the 1700s, and mixed-race black people during that time got more privileges, We're sometimes emancipated from slavery. We're able to get education. So this idea of sort of thinking about, like, you know, hair or curly hair being more acceptable or not as acceptable, it's because it really was not acceptable by law for a really, really long time. So we have to understand that, yes, this is something that is ingrained, but it is not natural. It is not a natural thing for us to automatically equate curly hair with something bad. This is as a result of what has happened in our American history that has taught us through laws initially that darker skin is not good, that black women are not beautiful, that our hair is not kept or acceptable or professional, all of those things. We're still dealing with, you know, the legacy of that. And so I think once we recognize that this is something that started a really long time ago, we can be more understanding of trying to undo it.
Let's take one more call. Brian is in Avondale. Hey, Brian, good morning. Go ahead.
Hi, Melissa. Thank you so much for taking my comment. I have two comments. I just wanted to touch up on the topic of diversity and how important diversity is, I feel like, to this topic. Me being from South Florida, I'm very proud of that. In Broward County, you know, growing up in the school system where there was Latinos, there were, you know, blacks, whites, you know, across the board. So, you know, as a child, you know, me being white Latino, you know, growing up in a household on my mom's side, white, you know, I was so used to, you know, white hair, you know, white hairdos, but I, being Latino, had, you know, very thick, straight, dark hair, you know, kind of being an oddball even in my own house. But, you know, back to the topic of diversity, I think that it helps diffuse some of the strong opinions and the biases and sort of the racism that kind of comes about, you know, hairdos, because I remember my own self as a child, young, being in the school, seeing different hairdos of all sorts, afro, cornrows, you know, the curly hair, big hair, you know, hair pushed back, you know, hair straightened. So I think that's helped me a lot, you know, especially in the school system, especially being a young child and now being an adult in the community, you know, being okay and comfortable with things like, you know, heavy dreadlocks or a bigger afro or, you know, rich curly hair, you know, rich wavy hair. I, for one, you know, love rich curly hair. You know, I always wanted it and I don't have it, you know. So, you know, it's just my two cents about, you know, that diversity and it being very important in this topic. And
yeah, Brian, thanks.
To a place where we can do that.
Yeah.
Thank you, Melissa.
Thank you.
Very much, guys.
Okay. And so, Dr. Wilder, obviously this is something people really have a lot to say about. A little bit more about this on our website later today. But, you know, as you said, ultimately, this is a really kind of joyful segment for us to do because, as Melanie Lawson said, and as you said, embracing your whole self is always a good thing.
Absolutely. And just to piggyback on what the caller mentioned, I think diversity is really important, but diversity cannot work unless there is inclusion. So in other words, it's one thing for us to say that we're all diverse and we're you know, that's important, but until we are included and included in an equitable manner, diversity is in vain.
Well, Dr. Jeffrey M. Wilder, as always, we love your insights on this program. Thanks for joining us. Dr. Wilder is a research scientist with the National Center for Women and Information Technology. We were also joined by Channel 4's Melanie Lawson Minor. Thanks, Jeffrey Ann.
Thanks so much.
Much more still ahead. Up next, a conversation with Glenn Weiss, heading up public art here on the First Coast. We'll be right back. Everywhere, daddy, daddy, hey. Long as God can blow it by hand. Let it fly in the breeze and get caught in the trees. Give a home to the fleas in my hair. A home for fleas, a hive for the buzzing bees. Let's go birds, there ain't no words for the beauty, the splendor, the wonder of my hair. Blow it, show it, long as God can blow it by. I want it long, straight, curly, fuzzy, snaggy, shaggy, ratty, matty, oily, greasy, fleecy, shining, gleaming, steaming, flaxing, waxing. Got it, polka dotted, twisted, faded, braided, colored flowers and confetti, dangle, tangle, dangle, and spaghetti.
The 2019 Florida Lawmaking Session, a fast-moving mix of policy, politics, and personalities. Follow the debates, watch the bargaining chips fly, and hear what it all means for everyone who calls Florida home. The 2019 Florida Lawmaking Session, every weeknight on Capitol Report.
Tonight at 6:30 on 89.9 FM.
Join WJCT and PNC Grow Up Great to celebrate Be My Neighbor Day, Saturday, May 11th from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. at the WJCT studios. Meet Daniel Tiger, Katarina Kitty Cat, and their friends. Tour TIAA Bank Field, meet community helpers, face painters, enjoy local food trucks, arts and crafts, and so much more. Reserve your spot today for this free, family-friendly community event by visiting WJCT.org. Start something good in your neighborhood.
Welcome back. Well, he's a renowned leader on public art, and now he's leading expansion of public art here on the First Coast. Glenn Weiss is director of public art with the Cultural Council of Greater Jacksonville, and he's here now with more. Good morning. Good to see you.
Good morning, Melissa. Thanks for having me here.
And welcome to the show and to Jacksonville. And it's exciting to have this discussion with you because public art is really busting out in a big way in this community. Tell me a little bit more about your portfolio and what you're trying to accomplish with public art at the Cultural Council.
Well, I think the main thing is just to continue the enthusiasm going. I mean, that's one of the things. I'm new to Jacksonville, but it seems to me as surprising the number of organizations and people and artists who want to find a way to create murals and sculptures and other events throughout the city.
How does public art translate to a more vibrant city? Isn't there data to show that it contributes not only to the aesthetics of a place, but even economic development too, doesn't it?
Well, you can go to, you know, Christo's big flags and Central Park, which generated $200 million of tourism dollars for the city of New York. Mm-hmm. You can go to that scale, or you can just go to the intimate scale of making a place pleasant and livable for people to want to hang out in and enjoy.
Now, when we think about public art in Jacksonville, everything from the big owl on the downtown library to the big baseball player outside the baseball stadium, those are all examples of public art. Murals, big public murals that Art Republic has created, sculptures on the Riverwalk. There's lots of great examples, but you are working on a lot of exciting new things, too. Can you bring us up to date?
I certainly can. So we're working, you may have remembered, in downtown, we painted all the columns related to the Skyway. And so the Downtown Development Authority is bringing us back again. We're going to do projects in the Elbow. It's going to be sculptures. It's going to be a cool sculpture where you look up. It focuses you on building elements. At the same time, creates a kind of kaleidoscope effect, which will kind of make an interactive activity. There will be new bike racks, new wraps. Those are just the downtown things. Mm-hmm. And we are also trying to stretch out of the city of downtown because, as you know, most of the artwork is either in downtown and a little bit at the beach. And so we're going to move. We're very lucky to be working out at the Legend Center and in front of Rebald High School and at the Cuba Hunter Park, which is on the south side of Jacksonville.
What are you planning for those spaces?
Well, those are just starting. Oh. And actually, people can still contribute.
They can give ideas.
They can give ideas. You just go to culturalcouncil.org, hit the feedback button, say you want to meet the artists, and give your ideas.
Oh, wow. Okay, so that's a way then for the public to sort of have some input. You know, before you moved to town years ago, there was a bit of a flap over this beautiful and kind of different looking sculpture out front of the Jacksonville International Airport. It's called the Goddess of the Wind. And when you drive into the airport, you can't help but see this thing. It's huge.
Okay.
And it's striking. It's different. It's a really interesting piece of public art. And I remember it was a little controversial at the time. And so public art is meant to be thought-provoking and striking and grab your attention and maybe controversial at times. That's really what it's all about, isn't it? You're trying to spark a conversation and get people to interact with it.
Absolutely. And the strongest point, what's the reason of introducing something to our built environment if it doesn't cause us to connect to it? Now, it can connect both at a controversial way or at a heartfelt way. Mm-hmm. Like, this is something that's really important to me and my life. And it expresses something that affects us.
Now, you, Glenn Weiss, have great experience with public art. You come to Jacksonville having overseen a lot of interesting public art projects in other cities. So you bring some background to this, which is exciting.
I do. I've spent a number of years in public art, from kind of my baby years out in Seattle through work in South Florida. And I had an incredible 3 years as the director of public art in Times Square.
And what was that like, running public art in one of the craziest, most exciting places on earth, Times Square, New York?
It was crazy. But the thing is that, you know, an artist would get to have their work in Times Square for one day, right? And that would mean 400,000 people would see their work and connect to their work.
Just for one day.
Just for one day. Right. So and so those kind of and using the giant billboards to create interactive pieces that it celebrated. We created a New York event called the Valentine Day Heart. So if you go there on Valentine's Day, you'll see a giant heart that kind of competes with the Christmas tree, not in a heartfelt way, but in a fun way.
How fun. Yeah. So this is a completely different built environment, culture, everything. But the, you know, it's exciting to see just this explosion of public art. You're even working on the expanse of grass in front of the county courthouse.
Yes.
Right? Well, you want to put something there?
Well, I think that's a really kind of complex space.
Okay.
Right? And so we're hopefully to have a think tank to come together this summer and talk about that. Because artists, people may or may not be aware of this, there are many very talented artists across the world who deal with landscape, who deal with placemaking. And so the possibility of giving them a mature program, mature ideas that come out of the citizens, and then let those artists imagine how a large landscape could be converted to a work of art itself.
You're having a public meeting, actually, this Thursday night to meet a local artist and get the public's buy-in on public art at Cuba Hunter Park. How can people be part of that?
They can just come at 5:30 on Thursday night to the park. It's off Emerson. And then they can also go on culturalcouncil.org, the feedback button, and we'll make sure they get another invitation.
All right. As public art grows around the First Coast, go to culturalcouncil.org to learn more about art in public places all over this area, especially as it moves out of the urban core, which is really exciting. And Glenn Weiss, the Director of Public Art with the Cultural Council of Greater Jax, we thank you so much for sharing all of this with us. It's exciting to see this growing.
Thank you, Melissa.
All right. In a moment, we're going to talk about a few things, everything from our movable feast to the Folkadup Music Festival, even WJCT's brand new jazz pop-up station. Much more still ahead. Keep listening.
Measles outbreaks in the U.S. are being driven by a dramatic surge in the virus globally.
Europe, unfortunately, has seen a huge resurgence in measles in the last couple of years. In fact, they've tripled the number of measles cases from 2017 to 2018.
And unvaccinated travelers are bringing the virus home with them. This afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today at 4 on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world. I'm Robin Young. We're in Alabama. The state's prisons have the highest number of murder and suicides given their size. Why is that? Also, you know, four little girls were murdered in the 1963 Birmingham church bombing. But there's a fifth little girl. Her sister was killed. She barely survived. That's next time, here and now.
This afternoon at 2 here on 89.9 WJCT.
On the next Fresh Air, Erin Lee Carr. Her new memoir is about her relationship with her late father, David Carr, a New York Times media columnist who had a large and devoted following. He was addicted to crack when she was born and got sober soon after. He was both father and mentor to Erin. She's now a documentary filmmaker. Her new film premieres on HBO Friday. Join us. Today at noon on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
Have we ever had it so good? The unemployment rate is hovering near a 50-year low. Wages are finally rising faster than the cost of living. But is everyone getting ahead? I'm Todd Zwillick. How do you feel about the economy right now? That's next time on 1A.
Today at 10 on 89.9 WJCT.
The Folk It Up Music Fest is coming up in downtown Jacksonville tomorrow night during Art Walk. Seven performers on two stages. Here with more, Carlton Higginbotham with the North Florida Folk Network and Shawana Brooks with the Jacksonville Public Library. Good morning, you guys.
Good morning, Melissa.
Good morning.
All right, Carlton. Two stages, seven performers, lots of live music. This sounds like a lot of fun. What all is going to be happening?
It's
going to
be fun. You know, one thing to understand is that folk music is a lot broader than most people like to think about it.
Yeah.
This is not the old days of the Kingston Trio and Peter, Paul, and Mary and whatever, you know.
Sure.
So it runs the gamut. I mean, my group, Old Dogs, New Tricks.
That's a great name.
And Dogs is D-A-W-G-S, by the way. we span the gamut, everything from hot club jazz to old time. And we will be doing that, in fact, at the park.
And you'll be at Hemming Park, right?
Hemming Park, right.
Okay, so there'll be a stage at Hemming Park, Shawana, and one in the main library. This is a partnership between the Folk Network and Downtown Vision. Sounds like it's going to be a really exciting night for Art Walk.
Oh, yeah, it's definitely going to be incredible. We try to do really full programming that go along with our exhibits. So currently right now, because we have a folk exhibition on that's on the fringe, Blurred Lines of Florida Folk, we thought what more perfect than to have a programming and talk about folk music. And that kicks off May, which is like a community history month. So we're just going to be talking about how great our folk network is here.
And there is a strong tradition here in Florida, Carlton, isn't there, that we can kind of really experience?
Absolutely.
This.
I mean, yeah, the musical experience in this area is unbelievable. In fact, Shawana and I were talking earlier about expanding the definition of folk. So, you know, most people think of it as really stodgy. You know, if it's not Woody Guthrie, it's not folk. That's not true. You're going to hear the entire gamut of music on Wednesday night if you come out to the park.
This is modern day,
right. Fun,
new 21st century.
Right.
Music, and it's really dynamic.
We want to expose people again. I mean, that's definitely always what the library's purpose is. We want to connect people, and how can we engage them with artistic performances that will hopefully get them wanting to create their own folk musical instruments and coming back into the library for the workshops that we'll be having after this festival, and where they'll be able to make their own folk instruments. And then come in for the books. We're going to always be talking about reading, and so we can get people activated and becoming the next folk artist of, you know, the future.
Excellent. So May 1st, tomorrow night, as Art Walk kicks off for the month in downtown Jacksonville, come out for the art and the street life and the books at the library, but also come up for the Folk It Up Music Festival. Seven performers, two stages, one in Hemming Park and one in the main library. Live music and lots of fun. So thanks, Carlton Higginbotham with North Florida Folk Network. Shawana Brooks with the Public Library. We'll see you out there tomorrow night.
Thank you.
We sure will.
And we are going to talk music for just a few more minutes here this morning as 89.9 decides, to great fanfare, to launch a pop-up jazz station. And that officially debuts tomorrow in advance of Memorial Day weekend and the city's jazz festival. Our music director and station manager, David Luckin, who always has something exciting cooking, is here to tell us more about this. Hey.
We've got the jazz. Over 4,000 songs in rotation. We quietly launched it Friday to make sure it's all good. So we've already been hearing from people. People love the jazz, and it helped get you in the mood for this year's Jacksonville Jazz Festival. So 24/7 with news at the top of the hour from NPR, full service radio station on HD4. And this is the kind of music we're playing.
And anyone, David, that wants to kind of chill out and listen to the pop-up jazz station, they need to have an HD radio.
And a lot of people have it in their car and don't even know it. So check out your car radio. If you've got HD, we've got classical on HD2. We've got what we call relax, which is kind of the music of your life from soul to Frank Sinatra. And now we've got HD4 with pop-up jazz. This is Bird Moves, a nice version of Freddie Hubbard's Little Sunflower song. He wrote that in 67, and here we are in 2019, and people are still making it fresh.
I love it. And how did you choose all the songs?
Oh, it's hard and it's easy.
It's magic.
You know, some great box sets. Let me tell you, Smithsonian Jazz or the Best of Jazz, or and all the musicians are there, from Count Basie and Duke Ellington, the early music, to Bird Moves and Eric Truffaz and Melody Gardot and Miles and Count and Billy and all the great stuff. It's really fun. I listened all weekend, and it's a real journey into jazz, like America's original art form.
Yeah, just like folk music, this is a true American,
truly
musical genre. So it's
exactly
exciting to kind of celebrate that, because as we said it a minute ago, Jazz Fest is a Memorial Day weekend tradition, so you'll be running this all through May.
All through May. And let us know what you think. Maybe we can keep it up longer. And to take us out, I'll let you close the show, but this is Duke Ellington in a mellow tone.
Okay, we'll close with that. It's our pop-up jazz station celebrating spring, May, and Jazz Fest. If you have an HD radio, tune to HD4 on the 89.9 spot on the dial and listen to some jazz all month. David Luckin, thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
And that's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Heather Schatz. Michelle Corum is our director. And if you have feedback, we always want to hear it. Send emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. 1A is up next. I'm Melissa Ross. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Enjoy a little Duke Ellington, and we'll be right back here again tomorrow morning.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.